I'm glad to be here. I'd like to recognize some of my co-authors on this work, Richard Nelson and John Sheehan and Bob Perlack and Lynn Wright. And since we do have a 15-minute break in between here, a couple of these authors, including myself, did contribute to that billion-ton, or I'd say at this point sort of the infamous billion-ton report. So I probably could answer some questions on that. Okay, well, as you heard from the previous speakers, crop residues are viewed as potential cellulosic feedstocks for bioenergy products, particularly bioethanol, although they could be used for other products too. And since corn stover is by far and away the most abundant crop residue in the United States, that's what I'm going to focus on. And the objective of the study that I'm going to be reporting on was to evaluate where and how much corn stover could be collected in the U.S. Sustainably. So we took, to address that question, we took basically a four-step approach to estimating corn stover supplies. First, we attempted to estimate the stover, and this is the tricky part, that needs to stay in the field. And we did that by, and I'll go into this in more depth, by considering both sort of operational constraints, like how much can you actually pull off the ground, given equipment constraints, and also sustainability constraints to removing the stover. When DOE started to first look at corn stover, the attitude was, oh, this is just all a waste. We can just take it all. Well, those of you who've been in the agronomy field a lot longer than I know well that the stover has a value to the soil, to erosion, so it's not a waste exactly. Secondly, we needed to estimate the gross amount of stover produced and where, and then to calculate, the approach that we took was to calculate the collectible stover as simply the gross stover minus the stover that's needed in the field. Pretty straightforward algebra. And then finally, to calculate the stover supply as simply that collectible stover times the acreage produced. So the hard part, estimating that stover needs to stay in the field. The constraints that we wanted to look at, and I'll get to the very last one, which we didn't look at, were machine limitations to collecting stover. We looked at some of the research that's been done in that area, and we concluded that at most, right now, you could collect about 75% of the stover from the field. And that's really a very optimistic estimate. Most of the time, it's going to be more like 40 to 60%. So assuming that you can get all the stover that's being produced out there is not particularly realistically. Secondly, there's places in the U.S. where you really need to leave the stover on the ground to conserve soil moisture. So the gray zone there is where we assumed that if you weren't producing the corn with irrigation, you couldn't collect any stover at all because you needed it for soil moisture. And that was developed with the help of Ron Follett. For considering the two other key components that we wanted to look at, erosion, we looked at rainfall erosion and the need to leave stover to reduce rainfall erosion in this part of the country, that blue area basically there. And for wind erosion, we addressed these particular states because we were doing a national assessment. But the very last one, the need to conserve soil carbon. We did not address that, and so I want to make that clear. And that was in part because at the time when we were doing this study, we didn't really feel like we had a model that we could run for all the different soils and all the different management conditions that we needed to run to look at this at a national level. I put in a plug for some of the work that Keith Postgen and John Sheehan have done using Century, and it was alluded to here using Descent. There's also been some more empirical work done by Wally Willem and Jane Johnson that's going to be I know they have a poster this afternoon. So there's been some more work on addressing the question of how much stover you need to leave to conserve soil carbon. But for my numbers, remember that I didn't really deal with that. So we tried to consider these constraints in the context of the variation in soils and climate you would see across the whole United States, and also the most common rotations in which corn was grown. Corn, soybean. And actually, in North Dakota and South Dakota, since at that time, the years that we are looking at, over 20% of the corn there was being grown in a corn small grain rotation. We looked at small grain rotations for those two states. And we also addressed tillage considerations. And so basically the question we are asking is, which constraint is going to require you to leave the most residue in the field? So rainfall and wind erosion, maybe I should go back here. For the soil moisture considerations, we basically said, if you fall in that gray zone, which is in the lower map down there, then you can't remove any corn stover unless your corn is being produced through irrigation. So for rain and wind erosion, basically what we did was for each county's agricultural soil and climate conditions using Statsco to define the soils, we calculated the stover needed to remain in the field to limit rain erosion to T or 1/2 T, T being the tolerable soil loss. And we considered the following six corn production scenarios. Basically continuous corn with three types of tillage practices, and corn soybean rotations with three different types of practices. One thing I would add right now, if we had to do this all over, I would have wanted to see a corn with conventional till and the soybeans with no till, because that would have, that's actually a more realistic rotation. The approach that we used was developed by Richard Nelson in consultation with Dave Lytle, and there's several papers that describe the approach in more detail, and it's based basically on the Russell equation. And so we basically analyzed every soil with a land capability class between 1 and 4, assuming that those were the lands that you would be growing corn on, and the soil specific values then were turned into county values using a weighted average based on the dominance of that soil type in that county. For wind, we used basically the same approach to estimating, a similar approach to estimating wind erosion, and it was a bottoms-up approach, again, based on WEQ, and it was soil-specific. And in the analysis, the wind erosion calculations were only sensitive to crop and to tillage, but not to the rotation. And again, we aggregated the different soil values up to the county. So estimating corn stover production, that seemed like that should be a very straightforward thing to do. But I'm going to tell you a few of the pitfalls. We chose to use a residue to grain ratio of 1.1. And that is the dry tons of stover produced in the field are basically equivalent to the dry tons of grain produced in the field. And then we use county-level production numbers from NAS for corn production and acreage to calculate sort of the gross stover that was being produced. And we used, at that time, the years 1995 to 2000. Well, corn production, as this bottom graph has shown, has definitely gone up in the last few years. So the numbers you see are, you know, off by that difference. Some of the pitfalls that we encountered is that residue ratios aren't constant. And you can get different values depending on whose research you read. 1.1 seemed like a reasonable sort of general average to use. And obviously grain production varies year to year. One of the funny problems that we encountered, and I just raise it because I saw it more than once, was the stover ratios were almost always done on dry weight to dry weight, but we saw quite a few papers where they took 56 pounds of corn, which is at moisture content, and then said, okay, I got 56 pounds of dry stover for every bushel, and went on that way. So we did not do that. We took out the moisture content, and that definitely reduced the amount of stover we produced by 15% right there. Okay, so for calculating the removable stover by scenario and estimating the stover supply at regional scales, we basically took each of those management scenarios for each county, and we calculated the amount of stover that could be collected for each of those management scenarios per acre. In some cases, where you had very flat lands in, say, Iowa, basically the major constraint was the fact that we couldn't get equipment to pick up more than 75% of it. In lots of places where we had more conventional tillage, if we had a wind constraint, basically we couldn't pick up any of the corn stover. That was an interesting result of the calculations of the WEQ. Basically, in all of those western states where you had corn production, the wind erosion considerations were high enough so that you needed to leave all the corn stover there if you were doing anything but no-till corn production. So we calculated basically for each of those management scenarios how much stover we could remove. Notice in the equation that our max constraint will stay constant over time. So if your yield goes up, using that equation, the total amount that you're going to be able to collect is going to change. And that's an important thing to remember, because lots of times the studies go and say, well, we're going to ask you, we want to tell you what percent of the stover you can take off. And the real question should be, how much do you need to leave on the ground? Because that's going to be a more constant term. And then you can go calculate how much you can take off, and therefore you can adjust when yields go up. You can essentially take off more if erosion and those considerations are what you want to address. So then the tricky part was saying, okay, so we had how much corn stover we could take off as a function of what kind of management scenario. So then we needed to know how much land we had in that county in corn production. That's easy to get off of NAS. And then we used the CIC values for tillage scenarios for that county, what percent of the county's corn was being produced with no-till or reduced tillage or conventional tillage. Rotations were harder to get because they really vary. And we could find information for that only at a state level. And so we used, so that's an unrealistic, but it was the best we could do at that time, given that we wanted to do the whole country. I'm sure you could do better if you wanted to pick a particular county, but we were trying to do a nationwide assessment. So that's basically how we calculated. So here are the results. Based on an average of 9.2 billion tons of stover, let's see, 9.2 billion bushels of corn being produced. Remember, now it's 13.1, I think one of our slides were. You produced about we produced about 217 gross tons of stover over the whole U.S. And the color code there looks just like what you'd expect. It's the Corn Belt. If you looked at the collectible stover, that's collectible given the tillage and crop rotations that were used between 95 and 2000, you can see we really shrink that base considerably. And then this bottom graph here is if we assumed that all of that corn, even if it was still grown in a corn-soybean rotation, was being managed under no-till, we can expand the results quite a bit. One of the things you do notice is you lose, basically, wind erosion is a huge, decreases the amount of stover that you can get in a lot of the West. If you look at the different states, this is addressing the main corn-producing states in the U.S., and the dark blue is under that the current tillage operations. The light blue is sort of the total gross amount that was being produced. You can see in some of the states, converting to no-till really makes a difference, particularly like, say, in Nebraska. But in all of the states, converting to a lesser tillage system increases your opportunities for reducing removing corn stover. There were three areas in the country that had very concentrated supply regions, and that was that were Iowa, sort of in the Iowa-Minnesota region. This is not a surprise to all of you who grow corn, Illinois and Indiana, and then also along Nebraska, along the Platte River, where you have so much irrigation. I show this slide in part to just give you a sense of how much stover we remove from the field in each of those regions, even though they were very high producing areas. And you can see that even in these very flat areas and the methodology that we took, we were only removing around 60%, or in some cases, sometimes even only 40% of the stover that was there. If you decided you were going to take a more restrictive perspective on erosion, it definitely reduced the amount of stover that you could produce. This is comparing each of the scenarios across the country and looking at whether or not you allowed erosion to go to T, tolerable, or whether you took a more restrictive and said half T. So in summary, what I'd like to say is, based on our analysis, about 30% of the corn stover produced in the U.S. could be collected given the constraints we were addressing. And I remind you, we didn't address soil carbon. Obviously, the greater adoption of the no-till management could really significantly increase the collectible amount of stover. And that increased corn yields will definitely increase the fraction of collectible stover, and not linearly. You'll get a bigger bang for your buck than a linear increase. And if you just assume that an ethanol yield of around 80 gallons per ton of stover, you could pick lots of different yields, but that's sort of an optimistic sort of near-term cellulose yield. The current collectible supplies, and I'm dealing with my 2000 numbers, not now, could produce about 4.8 billion gallons of ethanol, and that's about equivalent to the amount of ethanol that was currently produced in about 2006. Of course, that's rapidly increasing, so the number isn't true for 2007, but it gives you an idea of the magnitude of ethanol that could come from cellulose production, and obviously it could be a lot larger if your yields go up and you start to try to manage the land to allow you to remove the stover without increasing erosion. So thank you.
Since the next speaker's not here, we'll allow a couple of questions if there are any. One of mine, I guess, would be, is although it's a question of how much you can remove, it's also a question of how much money it will take to pry it out of the farmer's hands. And do you get much sense of that?
Well, actually, this study also looked at the cost. And one of the interesting things that we did discover is almost all the supply that we could get was coming from those lands where you could take a fair bit off. I guess that's not really too surprising, but if you looked at most of the supply came from lands where you could get 2 tons of stover per acre. And under that, we estimated that the cost, not paying the farmer for it, but covering the fertilizer costs and the harvesting costs, it would be about $30 to $35 a ton at the farm gate. So you haven't transported it anywhere. And so if you add to that whatever the farmer wants as profit, so our $30 did include the nutrient loss. It did, compensating for that. So you'd have to add to that what the farmer would want. So we were guessing more like $40, at least $40 a dry ton farm gate price. So it's not free.
And that $40 was several years ago as well, right?
Yeah. No, that's not 2000. The oil price, that's with a very different, that was before the really steep rise in the fossil fuels, so it would definitely go up.
Question here.
Well, I understand that the billion-ton study did not assume any material being available from pasture land, which is something like 200 million acres. Am I correct? Am I right or wrong about that? If right, why?
No, we didn't take much off of pasture lands, and that was largely because the yield is so low there, so that it wasn't real cost effective.
Okay. Any others back here?
Is anybody looking at, since we already have forage silage choppers, etc., mm-hmm. harvesting the entire corn plant at some timing between typical silage removal and normal grain harvest to find out if the corn plant, including the ear, has total value that's somehow better than using either one independently?
I don't know of work. Idaho National Energy Lab is doing quite a bit of work looking at the removal of the harvesting practices for corn stover and for switchgrass, but I don't know if they're investigating anything of like chopping up the whole plant. So I can't address that well, but that's where I would go to start, would be the Idaho National Energy Lab. Richard Hess there.
Yes.
I'm curious where on the water is going to come from all this
No, that was not. In the billion-ton study, it was just purely looking at sort of technical feasibility of feedstock. You're right. The the ethanol facilities do require water. It's not that they actually consume water, but they use it in the, I think, mostly the distillation process. I'll send that question to Bruce.
Time for perspective here. The oil industry uses 10 times the amount of water per gallon of gasoline as an ethanol biorefinery. You need to keep these things in perspective. It's 40 gallons of water per gallon of gasoline in an ethanol versus 3 to 4 in an ethanol process. Comparisons are always a good idea.
Thank you, Bruce.
Is that water used, or water used just to cool and then recycled back?
It's net water lost. It's makeup water.
Okay, is it then evaporated?
Yeah.
Okay.
Precisely.
Yeah. I think there's that's
yes.
Right there.
You said that the silver was costing $30 a ton to put up. What's the estimated value of that silver?
The estimated value.
What they could afford to pay for.
What are they willing to pay for?
Ethanol price.
Well, That all depends on what market you're looking at. And I'm going to step back. When DOE had a goal of trying to produce ethanol for $1.20 a gallon, it insisted on, it wanted to have a feedstock cost of $35 per dry ton. And that's sort of what it needed at that point, it thought, to get to $1.20. If you can pay more for your ethanol than $1.20 a gallon, then obviously you can pay more for your feedstock. And Bruce showed some examples of that in his first talk. Am I addressing your question?
Yeah.
Well, given $3 gasoline, what's really willing to pay for that?
Well, right now no one's willing to pay anything because you don't have the ethanol facilities that are demanding it, the cellulosic ethanol facilities that are demanding it. So it's sort of a modeling question right now rather than a market question.
Question down here, Ken.
Yeah, Robin, there's the cost of production is one way to kind of value the Stover, but the other way is to take what Stover's being the value that it gets in the marketplace for other uses. For instance, in Nebraska, it right now it's $60 to $75, and it's a knock-on effect of having so much of the corn crop diverted to grain ethanol production. It raises the value of cellulose in forages and livestock, ruminant livestock diets. So is anyone looking at the knock-on effects of getting a grain ethanol industry at 12 to 15 billion gallons a year on the value of cellulosic low quality forages, which is going to ultimately determine what the actual market value of the stover is, not the cost of production?
The group that I know one group that would be likely to looking at that, and that would be the group out of the University of Tennessee, Daniel Ugarte, and working with their polycyst model. And that's one of the things that we've been struggling with all along, is to try to get those feedbacks, because when I first got into this business, 15 years ago, it was really easy. You just looked at the cost. And because the market was so small, you didn't have to worry about any of those feedbacks. But as soon as you get up to this kind of a scale, you've got all of those feedbacks. And so you're absolutely right. But according at least to what Bruce was saying, that if we look at the energy value, then you can afford it at $60 a dry ton. But we'll wait to see how the market bears out that one, I think.
In the back.
I have to take issue with Professor Dale's comment about why it's used for gasoline production at a refinery. If you look at the National Academy report just published this summer, looking at water implications of biofuels, the figure they use is 1.5 gallons of water per gallon of gasoline produced at a refinery. And they cite the Sandy National Lab report just published this year.
I'll let Bruce answer that one.
Talk about that later, but the DEED database, again,
I guess I would add, living right now in the southeast with the drought that we have, you know, the water issue is one that needs to be addressed, but there's a part of me that says, since you're not chemically using that water in the sense of transforming it into some other chemical, in not being an engineer, I have this notion that the engineers ought to be able to find a way of conserving, recycling the water a little bit better. But having said that, I know that some of the power plants in TVA had to shut down some of its power plants because it couldn't return the water to the rivers because the temperature levels of the river, because they were so low, were so high that, you know, so you get those feedbacks that are really important. And so the water question is one that needs to be addressed. But I just have this optimistic perspective that you engineers can solve it.
All that I ask for is to make comparisons, that we don't do things in a vacuum. And so, for instance, the silly net energy idea. If anybody had ever asked what the net energy is, gasoline, all the years, the David Pimentel had been publishing on it, we wouldn't have this controversy we've got now. Net energy of gasoline is worse than ethanol. It's very easy to show that. And if we just make a comparison between
yes.
If they get it just from Sandia National Labs, though, I'm not sure Sandia is a hotbed of petroleum refining.
Yes.
Talking about comparison, so, you know, perhaps, you know, everyone talks about the different issue, but if biofuel costs $1.20 and oil fuel costs $3, what is efficiency? So, let's say, oil fuel gasoline would generate, let's say, 30 miles per gallon. How many miles our cars can do per 1 gallon of biofuel? And how we can address the issue that you call climate? You cannot start biofuel like in Brazil. They have cars that can switch. They cold weather, they start with oil, gasoline, and then when warms up, automatically car would switch to biofuel. How are car-making companies are collaborate with this issue? Where we are at this point?
I'm not really qualified to answer that. You do have an energy loss. Maybe somebody else does here.
Well, one of the things here, we're mixing. The question had to do with the efficiency and the price of ethanol and gasoline. We're kind of mixing wholesale and retail prices here. I think we heard yesterday that the wholesale ethanol right now is what, about $2? $1.70 or so. It's been up and down wildly, actually.
Yes.
And the import protection that we've imposed is keeping it bouncing. So it's a moving target. I think the simple answer why we don't have all of our cars running on 95% ethanol is it's too cold. And they not only have to start on gasoline, they have to run on gasoline. So, but it's an interesting question. Part of the reason Brazil has been able to move to so much ethanol is because of their climate.